This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The next episode of McHistory shows us an early feminist and educator from Bloomington Normal.
I have lived through several periods of smash-up. My first vivid personal experience in politics is of the corrupt period following the Civil War.
June Rose Colby grew to such prominence she had an ISU dormitory named in her honor. Plus, it's summer, people go on vacation, and they stop giving blood. It's a critical shortage time for donations, Eric Stock reports. John Norton gives us the Rock of Ages, and a new report from ProPublica shows State Senator Bill Brady has a significant financial interest in the Illinois video gaming industry at the same time a gambling bill is up in Springfield. ProPublica reporter Jason Grotto joins us. All that and a GLT news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A new report from ProPublica Illinois and WBEZ in Chicago indicates State Senator Bill Brady of Bloomington has significant financial interests in a video gambling company called Midwest Electronics Gaming. GLT has found that company owns about half the video gaming terminals in the town of Normal, for instance. Brady is also the Senate Minority Leader. The Illinois General Assembly is currently taking up a bill on taxation of video gaming interests. ProPublica started reporting on the video gaming industry last year. In January, there was a report that showed Illinois has more video gaming terminals than the state of Nevada. In fact, more than any other state, and the next to lowest tax rate on video gambling in the nation. When Governor J.B. Pritzker proposed raising the tax on gambling, ProPublica covered that issue. Reporter Jason Grotto was with us and tells us Brady's name surfaced as part of that reporting process.
The Senator declined to have an interview with us, so you know we weren't able to ask him directly. And the records for video gambling and gambling in general in the state, relative to other places like Nevada, are very difficult to come by. So there's a whole categories of documents that are not available to the public. We actually got these records probably by mistake through a FOIA request that allowed us to see the types of relationships, or at least some of the types of relationships that are out there. And what we knew already was that the senator was what they call a finder or a sales agent for video gambling. And so what that means is it's just someone who may have relationship with bar owners or any kind of establishment that pours alcohol can have video gambling. And there are thousands of people who have relationships with these locations that can go to them and say, hey, sign up with this video gambling operator who actually owns the machines and puts them into the locations. You know, if they can get a contract signed between a what's called a terminal operator or video gambling operator and a location, they get a finder's fee, which we were told can be as high as $50,000. So he had been working for Midwest Gaming, which is one of the larger companies in the state, as a finder since 2016. But then in 2018, he became what's known as a person with significant influence or control. And usually what that means is that you're getting some kind of revenue directly from the machines. So, you know, what our reporting found is that sometimes when finders bring contracts to video gambling operators, the operators may not want to pay up front. So what they'll do is they'll say, hey, we'll just give you a percentage of the proceeds from the machine. And that raises you up to a higher level where you actually kind of have a stake in how well those machines perform.
Or if
there's a tax on the machines, you know, how much money you get from them.
Do other top legislative leaders also have this revenue sharing arrangement, or are they sales agents?
All of the other ones that we saw are sales agents. So Mr. Brady has a unique relationship with the terminal operator.
Why, and, you know, why him? He voted against the original gambling bill.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, some of that might be politics. You know, back in 2009 when the bill was first brought up, you know, the senator was running for governor against Pat Quinn. Pat Quinn had supported this video gambling or video gaming act in part to fund a massive building program, a capital plan, the last one that the state had. And that was one reason the legislature pushed through the Video Gaming Act in 2009 to fund a capital campaign. And they said that, you know, that the industry would bring in $300 million a year. And, you know, within months of passing the law in 2009, they started borrowing billions of dollars. And in fact, it took 10 years almost for the industry to reach that level of revenue coming in. So video gambling originally actually hurt the state, not necessarily because of the industry itself, but because lawmakers started borrowing before the revenue came in. You know, most Republicans at that point voted against the Video Gaming Act. Since then, it's really become a bipartisan support for gambling in general across the state.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with ProPublica reporter Jason Grotto about a new and significant piece of reporting that's out today on ProPublica.org. Are there ethics rules that would require Senator Brady and the assistant Democratic Senate leader, who is also involved in the gambling industry, to not vote on the proposals currently before the General Assembly?
So from what I can tell, you know, and Illinois is not known for the strength of its ethics laws. In fact, the former Inspector General for the state has written op-eds about the holes that are in the ethics laws here in the state. I think it's a little squishy about whether he's required to abstain from the votes or not. What the senator pointed out was that, A, he did disclose his relationship with a company called Brady Ventures. So this is a company that he owns, and I believe along with his wife, or she's involved in it in some way. And so the video gambling company pays Brady Ventures. So he disclosed Brady Ventures on his ethics disclosures, but not Midwest Electronics. So there's, you know, you don't really get to see, because, you know, he's paid from Brady Ventures, not directly from Midwest, or at least that's what he told us. And then he also said that he does consult with ethics officers with the state, and abstains when he's told he should abstain. It was a little less apparent in terms of, you know, whether he participates in the many negotiations that are going on about gambling, and all of these things are interconnected. So,
as Senate Minority Leader, he's got to participate.
Well, that's true. The question is he disclosing to his colleagues his relationship, and should he be participating in those if he has a financial interest in gambling in general?
Do we know from either the Midwest Electronics Gaming or the Brady Ventures exactly what his revenue stream looks like? How big is it?
No, we have no clue. What we do know is that Midwest Electronics is one of the largest video gambling operators in the state, that it makes a significant amount of money every year. I'm not sure how much of that largesse the senator receives, or we don't know how many locations he has contracts with, or he helped get contracts for. We don't know any of this. None of that is disclosed.
You also note in your reporting that there begin to be monopoly concerns with the top five gaming companies in Illinois controlling about half the revenue stream.
That's a really, I think, a really good and important point. When video gambling was, by the way, Midwest has made $80 million between 2012 and 2018, for whatever that's worth, $16 million last year. So, to your point, there's actually a clause in the Video Gaming Act that says the gaming board will not allow undue economic concentration. Now, as is often the case in Illinois with these laws, what undue economic concentration means is not defined, and the gaming board has never done much to answer that question. So you've had a tremendous amount of consolidation in the industry. Many of the biggest operators have bought up smaller operators, and I think that there is a hope among regulators and others that, you know, that the industry will consolidate because it's harder to regulate so many companies. And the law itself is, as we reported in January, the law itself does not provide enough money for the gaming board to cover the costs of regulating the industry because of the way it's structured. And so that's a huge issue. We found that there was an $86 million shortfall in what it costs to regulate the gaming industry and what, or the video gambling industry, and what is actually paid by the industry. So that's a huge issue. You know, when the law was first pitched back in 2009, it was pitched as a way for small businesses, including small amusement operating companies. These are companies that, you know, put pinball machines and jukeboxes and stuff. And many of them were in the illegal, or what they call gray gambling business, where they would put simulated gambling devices in bars and whatnot. And the law was supposed to sort of help the small mom and pops, and what's happened is those have all consolidated, and you have a handful of companies that are dominating it now.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking about the video gambling industry and a new piece of reporting from ProPublica.org and WBEZ in Chicago. ProPublica reporter Jason Grotto is with us. You note in the story that the Illinois rate of taxation is about 30% of proceeds. Many other states are up at 50%. Would raising it to 50% catch up with the cost of administration that you just talked about?
Well, that would certainly go a long way in getting to where, you know, where, you know, the costs are for the Illinois Gaming Board. It's hard to say because a lot of it depends on how they structure the tax. So, for example, right now that 30% tax that's put on video gambling machines, 25% of it goes to the state, and just 5% goes to local government. And I think, you know, that's one area, and we're looking into this. Where, you know, any kind of social cost or, you know, boots on the ground oversight of these places, you know, is a local issue and a local cost, and they really don't get that much, the local governments. That's one area that might need to be addressed. The other issue is that Illinois ranks toward the bottom, 28th out of 40 from the last report that we saw, in providing funding for gambling addiction treatment. We looked at the fact that Illinois is one of the only states with significant gambling operations that has never done what's called a prevalence study. And this is almost a study where they look at, you know, try to figure out, like, how many people are suffering from gambling addiction. And this is a really important issue because over the years, as gambling has spread throughout the country, there's been a lot of studies, including brain imaging studies and other things, that have found that gambling, for a small percentage of the population, about 2%, is no different than drugs or alcohol. It has the same kind of impact on the chemicals in the brain. So, you know, 2% of the state of Illinois' population is well over 200,000 people. But we don't know exactly what it is here because they've never done a study.
GLT reporting on gambling addiction has shown that senior citizens are at risk of becoming addicts at a higher rate than the general population.
That's true.
And GLT's Mary Cullen has interviewed a couple of gambling addicts who say, who have talked about their trip down close to suicide and to prostituting themselves for money to continue video gambling. You can find that reporting at WGLT.org. But as one of the gambling addicts told us, no matter how much the money, the social costs will always outweigh the revenue. Is that something that your reporting reaches, that question?
Well, I don't think we've come to that conclusion. We haven't studied that particular issue. I mean, look, gambling and video gambling brings in a lot of revenue. There's no doubt about that. Last year, it brought in $1.5 billion, and the state got about, I can't remember off the top of my head now, but, you know, 25% of that. So it's not an insignificant amount of revenue. The issue is, on the social cost side, how much does it actually cost? It's a very difficult question. How many people go into bankruptcy? How many people are you know, become addicted, lose their jobs, use the mortgage to pay for these, put money in these machines? And I think that's a real issue that was never addressed when they passed the law. No one brought it up. There was one lawmaker who actually brought it up during the debate, and they never funded it. And that's something that I think, with all of the issues that are being pushed right now in Springfield, whether it's more gambling, sports betting, you know, marijuana, that they all carry with them costs, both regulatory costs and social costs. And there's very little effort by the legislature to try to enumerate what those costs are or study what those costs are. I think probably they don't want to know. You know, the state needs money, and so they're scrounging around for it. But one thing that we've been trying to make throughout is this isn't free money. It doesn't come without other costs. And if those costs aren't addressed over time, you know, it's going to be an issue for the state, because people will start to move against the machines. You know, in Europe and also New Zealand, there are movements now to get rid of the machines that have popped up because they didn't look into these things earlier.
Where next in your chain of reporting?
So we're going to be looking at, you know, local issues. That's one place. You know, many of the operators have gotten involved in local politics. You know, when the state first started, when the state first legalized video gambling, 63% of communities across the state opted out. They didn't want it. Over time, as the financial pressures on local governments have grown, and as the operators have pushed and lobbied to open up these markets to video gambling, you know, making the argument that, hey, you're missing out on all this revenue, the state now has flipped so that 63% of the communities in the state have these machines. You know, we did an analysis, a demographic analysis, that showed as the median income of a community falls, the number of video gambling machines increases. So, you know, in wealthy, really wealthy communities, you're not going to find video gambling. But as the wealth erodes, there's more and more of it. And so we're taking a hard look at how video gambling impacts, you know, local governments and local communities on the ground. And, you know, anyone who hears this that you know, has information for us or just wants to talk to us about it, they can find my email and contact information on ProPublica.org, and we'd welcome hearing from them.
In Bloomington Normal, the town of Normal has put significant geographic restrictions on the placement of additional video gambling terminals. Distances from governmental buildings, distances from schools. And effectively, that has redlined any future additions. The city of Bloomington, right next door, has done nothing of the sort. Have you found similar drastic differences in close geographic proximity yet?
In places where one community has opted out and another hasn't, so there are some that have none right next to places that do. We are hearing more and more about communities that are starting to say, like, hey, hold on, we didn't necessarily bargain for this. This isn't what we thought was going to happen. And so they're taking a harder look at how they regulate it at the local level. I mean, it's important to point out that at the state level, there is no cap. They can continue to putting as much video gambling machines out there as they want, and that's exactly what the companies, the operators want, or more video gambling. But communities themselves are starting to do things like increase the licensing fees. So local governments can put licensing fees on the machines, and so some are doing that. Others are doing what you describe, what's happening in Normal, where they're saying, okay, we're going to essentially cap the growth of these things. Because, you know, there are certain things that have happened, like there are these, I'm sure you've seen these gaming parlors, right? They're like, I describe them as almost like salons, except instead of, you know, getting your hair done or whatever, or haircut, they have 5 video gambling machines in there, and that's all. You know, no one contemplated those in the beginning. This was a thing that was supposed to help small mom-and-pop bars and restaurants and your fraternal and veterans organizations. And really, if you look at the numbers, which is what we're doing right now, these parlors make lots more money. The question is, you know, now that things have shaken out in ways that maybe the original framers didn't quite see, you know, how do we go forward with this? And there are, you know, local communities that are taking that in their own hands and running with it.
We have had some discussion in public municipal government about raising fees for terminals. But around the state, have you seen any impetus for communities to try to unring the bell and opt out after deciding that they're seeing too much money locally leaving the community?
Yes. One community, Forest Park, which is a suburb just west of Chicago, had a very contentious battle over this. And originally, members of the community put a non-binding referendum on the ballot. They won. The mayor of the town basically said, well, too bad, we want video gambling, we're not going to follow it. So there was a big court fight, and the activists that were trying to get rid of video gambling were able to get a binding resolution on there. And once that happened, what we saw was video gaming operators poured tens of thousands of dollars into this small community to try to fight this off. And, you know, local bar owners too, because, you know, they benefit from this. But at the end of the day, and in a pretty slim margin, the anti-video gambling folks won, and now there is no more video gambling in Forest Park.
That's a huge effort, though.
Huge effort, huge community effort, very dedicated, you know, people working on that. In fact, one of the people that was working on it ended up becoming mayor of the town. So it really galvanized people politically and, you know, has led to a lot of change in that town.
Jason Grotto is a reporter for ProPublica Illinois. You can read his reporting about the Illinois gaming industry at ProPublica.org. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, I really appreciate you having me on.
I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is GLT.
Support for GLT's summer concert comes from Night Shop, downtown Bloomington's destination for food, craft beer, and live music, and proud sponsor of the free GLT summer concert June 8th, featuring 3rd Street Down and headliner Adia Victoria. Concert details at WGLT.org. This is 89.1 GLT.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, a new episode of GLT's McHistory in cooperation with the McLean County Museum of History and producer Mary Cullen. Few people have given as much of their blood as David Laube. The Bloomington financial planner has given nearly 23 gallons of blood over his lifetime. Laube has joined the Red Cross as a board member for the Central and Southern Illinois region to help find more people like him, as the Red Cross is facing a critical shortage of type O blood. Laube tells GLT's Eric Stock, while he doesn't have that blood type, his blood does have one benefit that makes it especially valuable.
In my case, I've got a very high iron-rich blood for nutriments, because they always test that when you come in. They take a drop of blood and test your iron, which is one of the criteria to be able to donate blood. And because of that, and also I'm an A-negative blood type, which is fairly rare. I think about 6% of the population has an A-negative blood. So I was asked to donate double reds.
At what point did you decide to become this rock star of donating blood?
It's just a good thing to do. It's the right thing to do to help other people. It doesn't cost you anything except a little bit of time. It's a kind of what I call a psychic paycheck. And every time you donate, you're helping 3 people. Plus, it's good for your own blood system. Plus, it's just a psychological feel-good thing to help other people.
From what we understand now, there is a major shortage, a critical shortage of O blood. What causes certain types to fluctuate in terms of need? Does this follow any general pattern?
It falls in several things. Number one, there's always accidents. There are, you know, natural disasters that go on where, for example, right now, the American Red Cross is dealing with a lot of flooding problems where a lot of our donation centers around the United States have been flooded out or destroyed. You've got tornadoes, you've got, you know, hurricanes, all those kinds of things that will affect the need for blood. You know, car accidents, accidental shootings, all that stuff, constant need for blood. The Red Cross says they need about 13,000 blood donations daily for patients in about 2,600 hospitals alone.
How much of a supply is left?
The supplies are only good for, I think, about 42 days because blood is a perishable product. So we need to keep giving and donating because the need is ongoing.
And you would run out fairly quickly.
Yes.
We hear the need for blood from the Red Cross quite often. While the urgency may fluctuate, it's something that we still hear very frequently. The media is constantly hearing about the need, so much so that maybe it can get lost in the shuffle because it's such a constant message. How does the Red Cross get and keep that message out there in the public conscience so that people don't look past it saying, I've already heard this?
Well, first of all, among many things, the Red Cross is constantly working on educational programs within the communities we serve to educate our citizenry about the need for blood, how you can donate blood, how blood is used, and so forth. We're trying to permeate the school systems, both elementary, high school, getting people aware of that, for kids to take the message home to parents. We're very active on universities, and we work a lot through the business and corporate communities as well.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Eric Stogg with David Lobby, who is on the local board for the Red Cross for Central Illinois and is a prolific blood donor himself. You had indicated that just 10% of those who are eligible to give blood actually do. So what are the common reasons you hear why people don't?
Surprisingly, the number one reason is people said they just hadn't thought about it. That's the research shows that that's why people, what they tell us. But also there are people that have unusual ideas about they think it's painful or they think it takes too much time or they think because they had a disease or a problem or a health problem at some point in the past that they're ineligible. And many times that is not true.
How often do you have a conversation with somebody about this, addressing their concerns and showing them that their reason may not be valid?
Well, first of all, I've got literature in my office. I wear lapel pins daily about the Red Cross. I've got two of them on here again today. A lot of times when I'm standing in line somewhere, people will say, what are the pins about? So that gives me an opportunity to tell my story and to encourage people to donate blood. And if they can't donate blood for some reason, physically, for example, I said, you can always volunteer. You can always give money. And we have it's a volunteer organization. So when I got on the board, the thing I was most impressed with is the amount of induction training you go through and ongoing classes and ongoing education as board members to help us facilitate within the community to urge other people to get involved, donate blood, donate money, donate time, and give a little bit of yourself to help other people because someday you or I may need blood ourselves.
Well, the Red Cross has been offering $5 Amazon gift cards for those who give, and the Red Cross has done promotions like this in the past to spike donations. How effective have those campaigns been?
That I'm not totally aware of. I know they try different things in different times to try to urge people on, but I think most people really come and give because they just have a passion about helping other people. They want to do something good. They want to do something right, and it's an easy way to give.
Is there a threshold where you think the pot could be sweetened that would encourage more to give?
That's a good question. I haven't really thought about that. I know Maria Henneberry, our director of marketing and media, is really one of the people in charge of that. She's relatively new to the organization in the last year herself, and she's just doing amazing outreach with the media, people like you here at GLT, to get involved, that we need to get the word out and keep encouraging people to get involved.
So if I was to go to a blood drive today, and I roll up my sleeve, where does my blood go and how do I find out where it goes?
The first thing that happens is you get to read some literature about health background and so forth. They give you a finger prick and they test your blood for your iron and so forth. They check your pulse, your blood pressure. They ask you in private a number of medical questions that you do online, and then you go ahead and get blood.
And where does that blood go after that, and how do you find out?
The Red Cross has, first of all, they always try to drive the blood locally as much as possible for the needs through the hospitals and so forth, that right here in central and southern Illinois. That's our district right now. The second thing is Red Cross is a nationwide and worldwide network, so they're constantly in touch with all the other parts of the United States that need blood. For example, with all the floods in the southeastern part of the United States, a lot of the blood centers down there have been closed due to flooding or tornado hurricane damage. So sometimes blood will get shipped there, and that's all part of an automated system through the Red Cross.
And how do you find out specifically yourself as a donor where that ends up?
Well, one of the unique things that they started, I don't know, it was a year or two ago, where they send you an email approximately 30 days after you've donated that tells you where your blood has gone. The last time I gave blood, one of my pints went to a lady in surgery in Joliet, Illinois, and the other pint went out to Bethesda, Maryland for research.
How does that change your approach to giving to be able to see directly the end benefactor of your donation?
Well, I can't speak for everyone, but for me personally, that is an extremely motivating and very personal touch to realize I'm just not donating blood and it goes into some dark hole in the universe. It actually is going to some person or a cause that's going to help a lot of other people. And that, to me, again, is one of those psychic paychecks.
That was Red Cross board member David Lauby with GLT's Eric Stock. Lauby says it's critical that those who can give blood do so, since nearly 4 in 10 are not eligible to give for health reasons.
Building consensus is an essential part of our Congress, but it doesn't always go so smoothly.
Only 4 wanted to keep this provision. That's probably about the percent of people who think Nickelback is their favorite band in this country. It's pretty low.
Why would you criticize one of the greatest bands of the 90s?
Wow.
Democracy is hard, but staying informed, that's easy. Listen to Morning Edition every day from NPR News.
I'm GLT Morning Edition host John Norton. Join me weekdays from 4 to 9 a.m. on GLT.
Support for GLT Summer Concert comes from the City of Bloomington's Farmers Market. Open 7:30 to noon every Saturday morning on the historic Museum Square. On June 8th, the city welcomes the Something Brothers and 3rd Street Down to GLT's Summer Concert. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Now, you may well ask why 1980s-era fashion deserves a love note. John Norton will tell you in just a few minutes. From 1892 to the early 1930s, Professor June Rose Colby taught literature, grammar, and composition at Illinois State Normal University, one of the first female professors at the university. Colby was a pioneer as well for feminism. GLT's Mary Cullen produces this episode of McHistory showing the struggle of female professionals at the dawn of the equal rights movement.
I think the decline in teaching classical languages in schools is a great misfortune intellectually and morally. The real study of those languages calls in play our best powers. I never passed a day in the classroom when they were not vital to me.
Tell that fellow with a big physique to stop flirting with me. I'm not to be had. I'm changing my fad.
Hannah Johnson, Education Program Coordinator.
This is Bill Kemp, Librarian, McLean County Museum of History. June Rose Colby, one of the more remarkable women ever to teach at ISU, was born in 1856 in rural Cherry Valley, Ohio. But the Colby family so valued education that they moved to Ann Arbor, Michigan, so several of their children could attend the University of Michigan.
I don't have to sigh, don't have to cry, don't answer why, don't have to lie, but I'm not taking orders from no one.
And sure enough, June Rose Colby then will go on to earn first a 4-year bachelor's degree and then a master's degree from the University of Michigan. June Rose Colby overhauled her studies while at Michigan to concentrate on English literature, writing, quote, "I realized that if I wanted to get at people through what I taught, it would have to be in my own language." And of course, that is English, so she decided to give up the teaching primarily of Greek and Latin and move toward English literature, grammar, and composition. And sure enough, June Rolls Colby then becomes one of the first women to ever receive a PhD from the prestigious University of Michigan.
And the way the English language is slaughtered now is a tragedy. They are killing it with inane, empty, vulgar slang, and so many who want to use good English think that they must use stiff, academic language. That is not necessary.
Whenever I choose, I go where I choose and take what I choose, but I'm not taking orders from no one.
Even though she has a PhD in literature, she struggles to find a teaching position, obviously because she's a woman. So she has to spend 6 years teaching public high school in Peoria before in 1892 receiving a call from Illinois State Normal University to teach here in Normal. She becomes then the third woman in the school's history to attain the rank of professorship. And as Dr. John B. Freed has observed in his definitive history of ISU, Colby's academic credentials were actually more impressive than most of her male colleagues. But yet it did take her 6 years to get into a university.
The best book is not the most popular one. I managed this year, I say managed because I must be careful of my eyes, to read Moman in Peking and thought it worthwhile. And the world is in such condition that I have to spend some time with the newspapers.
Understandably, there's a renewed interest, or a first-time interest, I should say, over the last several decades in women educators in the late 19th and early 20th century. And what we're learning is that these women, because they were traditionally in relatively traditional environments, higher education, while appearing to adhere to the norms and strictures of late 19th and early 20th century pedagogy, were also silent feminists. Who employed discreet yet wholly subversive rhetorical strategies to undermine the patriarchal order of higher education in the United States at that time. So again, an extremely remarkable woman, very sophisticated, was able to navigate kind of the patriarchy of late 19th, early 20th century higher education as it existed at the Illinois State Normal University.
The position of women is still insecure and will be until the Equal Rights Amendment is passed to protect them against discrimination.
She was one of the better-known suffragists in the Twin Cities. Her longtime home was just on what used to be, and no longer is, on the north edge of campus at 302 West Mulberry Street. Where is that today? Well, that's the block, that stretch of green space east of Milner Library along what is now today West College Avenue, and her home was often the meeting place for the Normal Equal Suffrage Association. And interestingly, she was also an ardent supporter of an early version of the Equal Rights Amendment. This is in the 1920s, if you could believe it, what we would now call ERA. And that struggle, interestingly, of course, still continues today.
I've lived through several periods of smash-up. My first vivid personal experience in politics is of the corrupt period following the Civil War, and I've never idealized politicians, except Lincoln. There was something tragically moving about him.
In the early 1960s, Illinois State University opens the International Style or Modernist Residence Hall Complex, known as Hamilton Witten, and Atkin Colby. And of course, Colby is named for June Rose Colby.
My life is my own to do as I please. I'm at no one's beck and call.
And the other three buildings were also named for important women educators at Illinois State University. And ISU does have a good history of employing women educators from a relatively early period. So we had, as I said, built in the early 1960s, Hamilton Witten and Atkin Colby. We know about June Rose Colby. Alma Mae Hamilton taught English at U High or University High from 1915 to 1943. Jenny Witten was chair of the Foreign Languages Department at the Normal University from 1934 to 1959. And Edith Irene Atkin spent 35 years teaching mathematics at Illinois State Normal University.
For I always say, if I get by today, tomorrow, who cares?
Sadly, though, that complex fell to the wrecking ball in 2016, so the building that really primarily recognized the role of women teachers at ISU, no longer exists. So certainly one hopes that ISU can look toward naming other buildings in the future after some of these women, since these buildings no longer exist. So I would highly recommend a building named after June Rose Colby. Again, one of the more remarkable, not only women educators, but educators, period, in Illinois State Normal University's early years.
Today I live, tomorrow, who cares?
This episode of McHistory was produced by GLT's Mary Cullen, featuring Bill Kemp and Hannah Johnson of the McLean County Museum of History.
With some it starts and ends with money, but my heart is one thing that isn't for sale. I don't ask for sympathy or sorrow, and until I've said my last goodbye, here's the toast I give, my friends, today I live, tomorrow, who cares?
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The broadcast musical Rock of Ages is a love note to 1980s music and fashion. The Tony Award-winning show makes a stop at the BCPA in Bloomington tomorrow night. GLT's John Norton caught up with cast member Christina Waltz. She says the plot centers around a fictional Sunset Strip club patterned after the famous Whiskey a Go-Go and a rock star based on John Bon Jovi.
My plot line as Regina, I work in the mayor's office as the city planner. And the first time you see me, I'm in the office and these two German developers walk in unexpectedly and they bribe the mayor to knock down the Sunset Strip and build a mall, basically a strip mall.
Ah.
And I'm like, no, you can't do that. I'm like a hippie kind of Stevie Nicks character.
Okay.
And so I fight with the German developers, and in like the first moment you see me, I'm guns blazing, no, you can't knock down the strip. And then I get fired. So
so are you going to rock and roll after that or what?
Yeah, then I lead this huge protest against these German developers. So that's my plot line with them. And it ties into the Bourbon Room, because then the Bourbon Room gets a notice that they're going to get demolished. And then the owners of the Bourbon Room say, what are we going to do? We have to call Stacey Jacks and set up this big show. And it's you know, hilarity ensues. It's a huge triangle.
Okay. Well, if I'm reading the critics accurately, reading the tea leaves here, Rock of Ages, the musical, seems more like the show isn't so much about the script as it is about the music itself.
Oh yeah, it's a rock concert. I mean, the script and the story, it's very fluffy and it's fun and it's gonna be laughing the whole time, and you're in the story and you want the characters to succeed, but you really go to listen to the music. I mean, it's iconic. It's Bon Jovi, Journey, Stephen Perry, Pat Benatar. It's like you know all the words.
We're talking talking with Christina Walls. She plays Regina on the Rock of Ages musical. This is GLT Sound Ideas. How much of the show, Regina, is reverential about the 1980s versus poking fun at some of the aspects? As it sounds like that's what you were hinting at just a minute ago.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely pokes fun at the big hair and the outrageous costumes and the scenery of LA in the 80s and all the characters that you could see walking on the Sunset Strip. But it's pretty authentic, especially our version of the show. I mean, the Broadway early 2000s version was over the top with the hair and the makeup and the costumes, but our version of the show is pretty 80s authentic.
Are there onstage musicians during the show, or are you basically singing to a soundtrack?
No, they're totally live the entire time. We have three guitars, a bass, rhythm guitar, and guitar one, full drums, and keyboard.
And what songs do you get to perform as Regina?
I get to sing Hit Me With Your Best Shot, and I get to sing We're Not Gonna Take It by Twisted Sister.
By any chance, did you get a chance to talk to Dee Snider?
No.
No, I didn't. See what he thinks of your performance?
But I watched the documentary on Netflix about them to really get into it.
Well, that's a good point, Christina, because if I'm looking at the visuals accurately, most of the cast, you know, didn't grow up in the 80s, may not even have known the 1980s. I guess you just look at old footage. Is that how you kind of get an idea of maybe what it was like?
Absolutely. Our entire rehearsal process we did in New York City, and we had 3 weeks in one studio, and the studio was like head to toe covered in old pictures of like Whiskey Go-Go and the bars and the club scenes and what the hair was like and what the costumes were like and what our set was going to be, so we could really get into the vibe. I'm the baby of the group, so I'm the youngest, but our cast is kind of, for a national tour, is kind of on a little bit of the older side. Like, I'd say the range of age is 28, 29.
Do you get a chance to talk to the audience after the show? And if so, who are the people coming to this show that you can tell?
Oh, absolutely. When I come out of the stage door, a lot of people actually don't know who I am because my costume doesn't look anything like me. I have a brown wig, like almost black hair, and my natural hair is blonde. So when I come out, I have to be like, I was Regina. And then I start talking to everyone. And basically we get a lot of 50-year-olds in that age range. So like my parents' age. And then we also get a lot of like high schools that are doing Rock of Ages as their musical.
What do these 50-somethings tell you?
Oh, they love it. They just want to come up to you and be like, this was me, and like, that song played at my prom, or I went to a Journey concert and saw them live, and it sounded just like it. Because we're doing, like, the band plays all of the, like, if you were to listen to the soundtrack of, like, Don't Stop Believing by Journey, you know, that actual song, and then come to Rock of Ages, it sounds just like it. There's no fraying from the original.
Just a small town. Living in a lonely world.
Do you guys reference Guns N' Roses and or Nirvana at all in this show?
No.
The reason I'm asking is because it was Guns N' Roses who basically made spandex and spiky hair not cool anymore, and then Nirvana blew the whole music scene up in the early 90s, so I didn't know if you kind of went there, if you just stuck with, hey, we're having fun in the 80s.
Yeah, the show centers around that, like, iconic, so Journey, how else do I explain it? There's also a line in the beginning of the show that says, if a fire emergency breaks out and you begin to sing Pyromania by Def Leppard, yeah, that's right. He said, please don't, like, we don't have any of the rights to Def Leppard music. So I think another part of it also, when they were making the show, decided about which songs and which copyright they could use.
Interesting. So you're not doing the song Rock of Ages by Def Leppard either, then?
No, we are not. Yeah, that's not part of it.
The final question. So, Christina, you didn't live through the 80s. You're experiencing this, you know, as some of people experience the Beatles, right? They didn't go through that Beatlemania stuff, so they have to watch old video. Is there anything to take away from this show?
Absolutely. I've always kind of been an old soul, especially because my parents drove the 80s music in me even before I was in the show. So I've had this idea about 80s music before the show. But since being in it, I think that music today has really taken a turn. I think 80s music, even the 80s pop music, even the words and the music, they meant something. Even if you listen to like the Queen music, oh my gosh, that's like a full orchestra's worth of really just soul-wrenching music. But now music today is very different. Don't stop.
Rock of Ages cast member Christina Waltz speaking with GLT's John Norton. The musical send-up to 1980s music and fashion is at the BCPA in Bloomington tomorrow night. Curtain time, 7:30. Discover all other local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. WGLT.org is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Eric Stock, Mary Cullen, John Norton, and ProPublica reporter Jason Grotto. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.